I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining our show tonight. Tonight, our guest is John L. Crow. He's a PhD candidate and scholar of American religious history, joining us from Tallahassee, Florida. And tonight, we're going to survey the fascinating history of alternative religions in America. We'll explore how Eastern religious thought, ideas, and spiritual practices came to America at the end of the 19th century, and how these ideas not only influenced the foundations of American philosophy in the powerful ideas of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, but also how these ideas laid the foundation for great social change movements in American history in the years that followed. Alternative religions, beginning in the 19th century, have been long associated with activism, social reform, alternative health, and importantly, empowering women in leadership positions, when more traditional religion often marginalized women in leadership, women's leadership in the public sphere.
So before we introduce John, I want to give you a little bit of his bio from his website, which is www.johnlcrow.com. And I definitely encourage you to check that out. There's some fascinating stuff on there. So John L. Crow, PhD candidate in American religious history, has studied both American religious history and Western esotericism. His interests are wide-ranging, dealing with notions of the body within a religious context, the intersection of science and religion, and the development of Eastern religions within the Western world, particularly Buddhism in the West. Prior to coming to Florida State, he earned his master's degree in religious studies with a focus on esotericism at the University of Amsterdam. His undergraduate degree was earned in English at Kennesaw State University, Kennesaw, Georgia. John expects to complete his dissertation by the summer of 2014. John teaches a World Religion Survey course at both Florida State and Tallahassee Community College. In addition to teaching and coursework, he also assists or has assisted at a number of journals, including Church History, Studies in Christianity and Culture, East-West Connections, and the Japan Studies Association Journal. When he's not working with print journals, he occasionally contributes to the Religion in American History blog, one of, if not the best blogs, examining the current state of religion within American culture. John's primary research areas embrace modern spiritualism, theosophy and theosophical society, Freemasonry, Buddhism in the West, and theories and methods for studying the body. His dissertation work will be focusing on how the human body was understood by the Theosophical Society from 1875 through 1930. The society differed from most traditions in its approach to the human body. It saw the body as a matrix of seven different principles or parts and embedded within larger continuities of both a personal reincarnation cycle as well as part of humanity's evolution, leading from lesser to more spiritual beings. By examining the way theosophy approached the body, we can understand how science, religion, and occultism interacted and how those early occult understandings of the body have continued forward to today, informing numerous religious traditions, old and new. So welcome to the program, John. Great to have you here.
Yeah, John, thanks for joining
us.
I have a feeling that an hour isn't going to be enough.
Yeah, we're just going to scratch the surface of the surface on this one, I think.
We can start wherever you'd like.
Okay.
I think what we'd like to do is just get a sense of how you got interested in this topic, where you started and how you got to where you are.
Well, it actually started with an interest in a variety of religions, in particular like Egyptian, Viking, or Norse, Greek mythology when I was in middle and high school. But by the time I got out of high school, I was interested in Eastern religions and had been reading about that. I earned my undergraduate degree at Kennesaw, and while I was there, I applied for a scholarship to go study at a Buddhist monastery in Taiwan, and I was awarded that. And so I spent a month at a Buddhist monastery going through like a semi-monastic program, but doing lots of meditation and then talking to some of the greatest minds about Buddhism in the world. And one of the discussions that we had was with a nun named Yifa, who got her degree at Yale. And we were talking about how Buddhism, when it goes to each country, really changes. And so the conversation was like, how was Buddhism changed by coming to America? And that topic really got me interested. And in researching Buddhism, I found out that it was so, in its beginning origins in the West, it was so tied up with Western esotericism. And so I did my master's degree on one of the first Englishmen who left an esoteric tradition in London, in particular the Theosophical Society and a group called the Golden Dawn, and he became a Buddhist monk. And then from there I started studying the Theosophical Society, and so it kind of all snowballed from all of those interests.
What is Western esotericism? How would you define that?
Well, that's a good question. There's lots of people who are debating that. But in general, Western esotericism is a tradition of a certain kind of worldview. Many scholars debate on where it originated. Many think that it's kind of a worldview that emerged out of the time of the Italian Renaissance that was trying to reconcile older worldviews of, say, Platonic or Neoplatonic as these texts were being discovered. Rediscovered by the West, and as well as Christianity and the new sciences that were emerging with the Enlightenment. So it was kind of all of these different ideas circulating, everything from the Hermetic tradition of Egypt, and that they all tried to unify into this one kind of lineage of wisdom going back through time. So it's very heavily influenced by Platonic ideas and so forth. These have then traveled through different forms over time, and different people have picked up these ideas and worked with them. So it's kind of like this transmission of knowledge or gnosis or things like that that different groups have tried to tap into. Now, that's not me saying that there is this one knowledge that exists out there, but they would make claims that it did and that they were participating in that kind of knowledge.
Okay, and I have a feeling we're going to probably weave in and out of that with various names and people and circumstances throughout the history that we look at. Yeah. I'm curious, how do we approach the history of alternative religions? What are the broad strokes that you can lay down first to set context to then just dive in and begin to unpack this a little bit?
Well, the United States has always had a love-hate relationship with religious freedom. I'm teaching a course right now at Florida State about the history of religion in the United States. And right now with my students, we're going over the Puritan times and looking at the 17th century. And we would like to think that America is this bastion of religious freedom and tolerance and so forth. But actually, if you look at the beginning of the United States, it's far from it. So the Puritans were getting persecuted in England, and to some degree in Netherlands, so they came to the North America. Then they started persecuting those who dissented against them, who then persecuted people. And it's this long chain. We also get a number of different states that are founded under the Anglican Church or Quakers or Catholics and so forth. So there is a lot of religious diversity, but there's a lot of tension in that too. And I would say the history of religion in the United States is that kind of tension of different religions emerging, importing, establishing themselves, or emerging once we get into the 19th century, because we have new religions that are founded in America, but also that tension and pushback against them by more established traditions. So that kind of negotiation and the way power circulates with those groups is one of the areas in which I study, in particular, looking at how groups emerge in this environment where they're the minority, and how do they work around that. There's a history of othering in America, but then also kind of championing the other. So there's some really interesting juxtapositions to look at historically.
I had a quick question based on the history that you were just giving us. A lot of people these days are very interested in sort of Native American traditions and Native American, I don't even know if they want to call it religious traditions, but maybe it is. Mm-hmm. And just curious, around the time that this country was started, was there interest in when the Puritans came here? Did anyone actually actively seek out and try to understand the Native Americans' point of view or their religious beliefs or their spiritual beliefs? Like, was there cross-pollination back then, or was it marginalized back then?
In most cases, and again, I have to speak in generalizations, there's always exceptions to the rules, but in most cases, the religious or spiritual traditions of Native Americans were completely dismissed by Europeans, and those who did learn them often learned them as a means to try and convert them to Christianity. So, for instance, there was a Puritan named John Eliot. He translates he learns a Native American language so that he can translate the Bible into it and then therefore give them a Bible in their language. Or we see various kinds of French priests setting up trading posts and so forth so that they would have interactions with the natives in an attempt to get them to convert to Catholicism and so forth. So in general, the Europeans did not see Native Americans as having a religion or spirituality of their own, and it was only later in the 19th century and even in the mid-19th century that there was an acknowledgement of an independent religious tradition, and by then there had been so much interaction between Europeans and Native Americans, plus the massive genocide of Native Americans due to either war or the illnesses spread, that by then there was no pristine Native American tradition for anyone.
That's what I was wondering. Like, is there sort of a lack of continuity then? So what people are actually saying today is that Native American spiritual culture may actually be it's some kind of a combination of things, unless you're getting it directly from that lineage, which would be almost, from what you're saying, pretty impossible.
Right, because Native Americans generally transmitted their knowledge orally, and when you have multiple generations dying due to smallpox and other diseases that were either unintentionally or intentionally spread by the Europeans, there's no time for that oral transmission. So you end up losing traditions. Now, probably the one Lakota Sioux medicine man named Black Elk that many people look to is he was a trained medicine man within the Lakota Sioux tradition, but he was also heavily influenced by Christianity and at one point converted to Catholicism and did not see any conflict. So many people turn to his rituals and ceremonies that were documented in the mid to late 19th century because in some cases that's all they have.
That's fascinating. Thank you for that. It just occurred to me when you were talking that it seems like what a lot of people think, that maybe they're directly connected to that lineage. It seems it would be very difficult to actually find out what was going on during that time.
You know, and before we move on, I have a question just about the championing the other or othering people. So whether we bring them into our fold, accept differences, or whether we actually alienate, what is it in human, and this is maybe, just a really, fundamental question, but why is it important that we share creation stories with others? Like the sense of our origin or the story of what why we're here, who we are and where we're going. Why is that important that we share that with other people such that we would actually try to convert them?
Well, I mean, this is really one of the fundamental questions that many scholars of religion are asking. Like, what is this core motivation? Some of them are coming back and saying a lot of this is about identity. That you define yourself in contrast to others, or you define yourself by those who adhere to your beliefs versus those who don't. So it's this, it's not about a positive statement, I'm this, it's more statements of I'm not that. And we can definitely see those kinds of dynamics in religion. I mean, you can go as far back as, for most of the religions that people are familiar with, say Christianity defined itself as not Judaism, and Judaism defined itself as not Roman in Egyptian religion. And then as time goes on, we get Protestantism emerging out of the Reformation, and Protestants define themselves by not being Catholic. And so this kind of identity and contra the other is a very fundamental aspect of how people come to know who they are.
That's interesting because we're, at the heart of most of the older traditions like Buddhism, you come if you follow Buddhist practices, the recognition is that it's all one and we're all connected, and we couldn't be separate, and yet we have this and yet in terms of the development of different religions kind of creates this natural separation. So there's an interesting pull happening between creating that otherness and then the fact that we are actually all, we all do come from the same source and we are fundamentally not separate.
What you're pointing to is very much a fundamental tension within most traditions. So let's say you want to look at something like Hinduism with its tradition of the various varnas or castes. Yet there's this assertion of unity of everybody is Brahman, but even though everyone's Brahman, there still is the manifestation in this world of the caste system of difference. And so you end up having these different kinds of unity versus not unity aspects of each tradition. Everyone's one in Christ, and yet there is still these differences between different forms of Christianity. There's everybody who's Jewish is part of the covenant with God, and yet there's these different forms of Judaism. So there's always this unity difference tension within traditions.
So how do we understand this explosion that seems to have happened in the mid-19th century, where you have Mormonism that seems to have taken hold? You've got the Theosophical Society. You've got what's behind this, what seems to be like a huge cultural explosion and change happening in religious thought?
Well, scholars think that one of the important differences about America is the non-establishment of religion. And during the time that North America was populated by Europeans, America emerged, and then we have this tradition, new tradition of a Euro-American government. This is all in contrast to European states that have a joint connection between a state religion and a state government. They're very much hand in hand. I mean, if you look at England, the monarch is the head of the church. If you look at other governments, say France or the Scandinavian countries, the governments collect religious taxes and then give it to the churches. So America has this kind of opportunity for people to have to develop religion on their own or not. And this has created what some scholars call a religious marketplace. And this results in various people competing and creating new religions and having new revelations. And it's this kind of spiritual hothouse that religions develop.
And who are some of the important names to know in this time period?
So if you're looking at some of the real important traditions coming out, you mentioned Mormonism. So this is in the early 20th century. Joseph Smith has his revelations and intercourse with the angel Moroni. And then you start looking, you can see in the 1848 in upstate New York. In fact, upstate New York was such a place of religious revival and religious innovation that it was called the Burned Over District because there was just so much religious activity there. We see the Shakers emerge. We see the Millerites. This is a Christian apocalyptic group that their predictions of the end of the world didn't happen, and then they reorganized. We see them turn into the Seventh-day Adventists. We see spiritualists, and then in Boston you have Mary Eddie Baker doing Christian Science, so, and mental healing, which is a kind of follows the trajectory coming out of Europe of mesmerism. So we start seeing mental healing kind of traditions associated with that. So these are some of the bigger names of traditions that emerge. But the reality is there were a lot of lesser known spiritual movements, when I say spiritual or other kinds of religious movements, and different people were prophesying all the time. It was a a pretty impressive amount of religious innovation coming out of that tradition that so many of those traditions still exist today.
Is there any particular tradition that was really popular back then that didn't make it into the present that you find really fascinating or interesting?
Spiritualism is probably one of the most interesting. Estimates are that by the time you get to the 1860s and 1870s, there's anywhere between 2 and 8 million spiritualists in the United States. Now, this is out of a population of somewhere between 35 to 40 million. So it was a large number of adherents to spiritualism, and they were all different kinds because spiritualists, especially in the first two or three decades, did not really organize into churches proper or associations. It was a very loosely organized, independent kind of tradition where somebody could claim that they're a medium and interact with the spirit world and start having seances and so forth. So that one did not really last from the Depression. By the time you get to the end of the 19th century, it starts to wane. It had a bit of an uptick after World War I of people wanting to try and get in touch with loved ones who died in the war. And then by the time you get to the end of the 1920s and the Depression, spiritualism really has diminished.
Any sense why?
It still exists today. I'm sorry?
Any sense why? What had it diminished?
The kind of questions that spiritualism was asking about the other world, about life after death, about these kinds of scientific surety, those kinds of questions had shifted focus, as well as a lot of the movement had been kind of undermined by numerous mediums having fraudulent practices and being discovered. People know of Harry Houdini.
I was going to mention Houdini.
So many of these fraudulent claims and apparitions and so forth really undermined the legitimacy of the tradition, too. So there were a number of factors, and there were organizations that kind of spun off. And the one I study in particular, the Theosophical Society, ended up spinning out of spiritualism and repudiating spiritualism around 1875.
On the Houdini story, do you happen to know? I remember watching the movie probably in the late 70s or early 80s, and some of the movies that were made about his life suggested that he did somehow manage to come back and contact his wife. Do you have any definitive information on that one?
What's the inside scoop?
No, unfortunately, anything I've read about it always said that he was disappointed that he never. Because he had some kind of code system that he worked out with his wife, that whoever died first and could come back would communicate. As far as I'm aware, that I never heard that was he had received a message from her.
That's too bad.
But I don't claim to be a Houdini expert at all.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie Zeitgeist?
I have.
And what's your opinion on that?
The things that, like the beginning part about the solar deities and so forth regarding Egypt, that was a very common theory in the 19th century and early 20th century about the unity of all the gods being sun gods and all this and that. And this goes along with claims of various kinds of universalism and so forth. So that is participating in that kind of historical narrative. One of them was on the banking, and I'm not an economic person, so I don't have anything to say about that. And there was a third part. What was that other part about?
I can't remember the third part, but I was asking you specifically about just about how I felt the beginning part of the movie really went into how Christianity was pulled, all the pieces of Christianity were pulled together from other different religions.
So that's right.
What I was particularly curious about.
Yeah. You know, there's lots of these kinds of claims that this religion or that religion isn't original in what it's doing. It's really hard to take those kinds of claims seriously because when a tradition borrows, and all religious traditions do borrow from other religious traditions, they end up incorporating them and making them their own. So, for instance, from that own kind of argument, you could say that the Eucharistic ceremony of Christianity is simply, a modified Passover ritual or something like that. But it's not. It's a completely different ceremony, different context, different everything. And the same thing with the adoption of various kinds of Christmas customs and so forth into Christianity. There might be some similarities between the uses of trees in other traditions or the Easter Bunny or whatever. In fact, I was talking to my class about the Sinterklaas from the Netherlands and Santa Claus and how he was developed by Coca-Cola in the 1950s. There's connections between them, but in the end, Santa Claus is his own thing, and he has his own existence in, separate from the sources that he came from of this Catholic bishop that gets celebrated in the Netherlands as Sinterklaas. And in fact, Santa Claus has now been reimported back into the Netherlands, so they have both Sinterklaas, which they celebrate at the beginning of December, and then they have Kerstman, who is our Santa Claus, who they celebrate at the end of December. So they get it both ways.
Hey, with the Theosophical Society, who are the big players there? I think you mentioned Madame Blavatsky in our last conversation.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about her and maybe the influences of the East and how that happened?
Sure. So I would argue that the Theosophical Society is one of the primary organizations that introduced Eastern religious practices in the West, both in the United States and Europe, as real practice, living traditions. A lot of people will point to scholars such as Eugene Bernouf in 1840s publishing texts, or the Transcendentalists and so forth, and their interest in Buddhism and Vedanta and stuff. But those are always more philosophical or literature-based interests. The Theosophical Society really tries to adopt Eastern practices as a lived religious tradition. And so they start importing various practices, including the belief in reincarnation, the cremation of bodies, meditation, yoga, all of these things they bring from the East, in particular India, and then they bring them to Europe and America as actual religious practices for people to participate in. Then if you go forward about 20 years to the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893, we see a very ecumenical attitude from liberal Christians establishing this meeting, bringing in Indians and Japanese, Chinese, and so forth. And here we start seeing real interest in Eastern religions. And the Theosophical Society was a big part of that World Parliament. So it's really in those last three decades of the 19th century that these religions really start taking off as practiced religions, that is.
Great. John, we're going to take about a 30-second break here, and we're talking with John L. Crow. He's a scholar and PhD candidate in American religious history, and we will be right back on Bridge to Everywhere.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, broadcasting as KVRF. FM 89.5 on your FM dial. Contact us at radiofreepalmer.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I'm Kevin Middleton, and you're listening to our interview with John Crow. He's a scholar of American religious history. And John, do you want to pick up where you left off?
Well, I think the important thing to keep in mind is not only are they importing both the Theosophical Society, spiritualism, and these other religious traditions, they're also importing new ideas about social relationships. And so we can see how these traditions, such as spiritualism, Theosophical Society, or even these other alternative ones, such as the Shakers or the Seventh-day Adventists, Christian Science, all of them have very prominent roles for women. So in the Theosophical Society in particular, we see Madame Blavatsky as kind of the font of mystical knowledge. And then after her death in 1891, we see Annie Besant pick up the leadership of the organization. So there's a strong female presence in the Theosophical Society, as there was within spiritualism. There's a scholar named Anne Browdy who has convincingly argued that spiritualism opened up avenues for women that traditional religions did not. So whereas women were told to be quiet in the pews of Christian churches, couldn't have leadership positions in Christian or Jewish churches or synagogues, we see these traditions actually open up real leadership. They're either founded by women, co-founded by women, and the women have huge leadership and theological roles within the traditions. And it's not surprising then we start seeing many women flock to these traditions looking for opportunities of spiritual or religious fulfillment that also recognizes their validity and leadership in society.
How is that received in the lives of families and community and in a patriarchal society?
As you might guess, not good at first. So, there's a lot of negative. What we're talking about here is what scholars have come to call first wave feminism. And so it's a very mixed kind of environment where the various spiritual or religious traditions reinforce the claims of social reform. So we start seeing women and men standing up and calling for marriage reform. And in this case, marriage reform could mean anything from free love to, as in choosing your partner, like when you can get married, when divorced and all that, to having multiple partners, to for women to even have property rights. In most cases, in the 19th century, when a woman married, she lost all rights to her property, name, and so forth. It all reverted to her husband. So the children are owned by the husband or had custody and so forth. So there was all of this kind of efforts to reform that. Of course, there was the suffrage movement and dress reform, employment reform. All of these different kinds of reform movements kind of dovetailed into these spiritual traditions that gave the women and men involved in them legitimacy to make their claims to reform society.
It's kind of surprising because I didn't really know that. You know, I think about what we learn in about history in high school, and if you didn't study religious history, you probably wouldn't know that. It didn't really occur to me that that's where some of these social reform movements began.
Yeah, well, in defense of the historians who gave you the history that you study, a lot of the conventional historians struggle to fit religion into the narrative, and because of that struggle, often they just drop religion out of it. And that's unfortunate, but there are now a large number of scholars who have the training to be able to appreciate and incorporate religion as one factor in all of this kind of social change.
Now, how does American philosophy and the powerful ideas of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, how does that fit into the picture in this time frame?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a lot of people look to the transcendentalists, Emerson, Thoreau, and so forth, as real leaders in these kinds of areas, and they are. If you, for Emerson, Unitarianism was too rigid, right? He's looking for a very kind of open spiritual path or religious path. You have Thoreau doing so, and they end up looking at these Eastern traditions. They're in the mid 19th century, and so they're looking at things like the translations that are coming from Europe. So for instance, in The Dial, which was this a really important transcendentalist magazine, we see Thoreau translating from French into English Eugene Bernouffe's translation of the Lotus Sutra. We see Emerson reading from the Bhagavad Gita and other Vedanta materials and talking about that. we see other transcendentalists looking at Buddhism and Hinduism. So they really adopted these kinds of other ideas and worldviews and tried to incorporate them in their own. They did it for more of a philosophical bent than a religious, but it really did open the way for a lot of people to take these ideas more seriously and start to incorporate them in their own traditions.
I see. And it sounds like in the Theosophical Society, they were really committed to embodied practice and deep discovery of what these ideas or teachings from the East really meant in a life. And from that came social change, activism.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the Theosophical Society itself was not an activist organization. They were interested in changing a person's understanding of who they were on a more fundamental spirit level. But almost every theosophist that I've read about was involved in activism in some form or fashion, especially someone like Annie Besant. Even Blavatsky was involved in reform or supporting reform movements, including suffrage. So now sometimes they had a different take on the best way for women to move forward, and this is an important thing about first wave feminism. It's not a monolithic movement. Lots of different women saw different needs and reforms and argued amongst themselves. But in general, the religious practices empowered women to value themselves and to speak out in public.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about what your dissertation project is going to be on. So how theosophists actually saw the body and how that differs from, you know, maybe conventional Western thinking about what is the body.
And tie that in with the alternative health movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a problem. So one of the things that is coming out of the Enlightenment is this notion that humans are a body, a mind, and a soul, you know, this three-part kind of division of a person. Theosophists, building on other kinds of ideas coming out of the East and so forth, asserted that humans were actually seven principles, they frequently called it. And this is starting on its lowest material sense in the physical body, but on its highest sense, the spirit level. And then they had a whole bunch of what they called planes in between. They had the etheric plane, the astral or emotional body, the mental body or mental plane. And so all of these had a level of materiality that could be demonstrated by those who had clairvoyant abilities. And so we start seeing a connection between the claims of these planes and these levels of existence of people and claims that you could then start evolving spiritually at them and or healing people on them. So, for instance, if you had someone who was clairvoyant, they could interact with someone and see how they existed on the mental or the emotional plane and see the body on those levels, see the aura and so forth, and start making diagnoses on how people should heal themselves or get therapies and things like that.
And just for fun, do you have any particular definition of the word clairvoyant? Like, is there any kind of acceptable definition of what it means when you say somebody's clairvoyant?
Yeah, it's a very loose term. I would guess in this context I'm talking about someone who has a kind of sight that goes beyond a conventional sight, so that they have some ability to see what they claim is on higher planes of existence, whether it be the astral plane or other kinds of spiritual or material planes. So, for instance, someone who can look at someone's astral body or look at someone's aura or travel even astrally out of the body might be considered to have clairvoyant powers. They manifest in different ways for different people, but the term clairvoyant is frequently used as kind of a catch-all.
Yeah, and do you know when that term came into vogue? Like what, maybe which alternative religions started using it or where it actually shows up in our language?
I do not know the etymology of it. I'm guessing it probably has a French origin. I know it was used in the Theosophical Society very early, But its actual source, I do not know. I apologize.
Oh, no, that's okay. I'm just kind of curious because it's just the idea that to have the words for, you know, another sense. You know, most people grow up thinking about five senses, and just curious, like, where that idea came that there could be something other than what our senses pick up.
Right. I mean, things like ESP or the sixth sense, terms like that are used today, extrasensory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or one more sense. That also has kind of the grouping all particular extrasensory perceptions into one thing called ESP. So you have that same kind of collapsing everything into one term, even if it's not the term clairvoyant. But the actual origin of that term, I do not know.
So it's interesting that on one hand we have this this sensitivity that seems to be cropping up with looking deeper beyond just the material reality, but at the same time period, scientific advances are exploding. And so it's an interesting contrast happening culturally. And I'm sure that, you know, clairvoyance and the movement in alternative medicine was full of charlatans as much as credible practitioners. And I'm wondering if you have any commentary on that, and also maybe some stories that you've come across that were particularly credible and really impressive to you.
Well, it seems that as soon as you are starting to assert a different kind of metaphysical reality, and this is something that we see really starting to emerge in the mid 19th century, because with science and with better demonstrability of the material world, advancing therapies and medicine, and a more materialist understanding of the world, we start seeing the distance between this world and what you might call the spirit world. Those kind of differences start to collapse. And so with spiritualism, you start getting a medium who says, well, actually, the spirit world is just like this world. It's just on the other side, and it has a kind of materiality, too. Then if you start carrying that forward into something like Theosophical Society, they start saying, well, yeah, the astral plane, the mental plane, these have materiality also. And therefore, if it has materiality, it can be objectively tested with the sciences, and therefore we can scientifically test these things. Now, how does that work out? Well, we know in spiritualism quite frequently the tests that were made to manifest these things didn't produce the results, and so we get lots of claims of false mediumship and so forth. And this is no different than today with paranormal investigators, ghost hunters, and so forth. They're still trying to do the same thing that spiritualists were doing in the 19th century, trying to demonstrate spiritual claims. So while mediums are saying, well, they're talking to spirits, you know, you got ghost hunters going out and taps and so forth saying they're using their EVPs and infrared cameras and all of this other technology to capture, you know, the existence of ghosts. And so we start seeing scientists. There's the Psychical Research Association that is both in England and America that really starts putting these things to a test. They start doing various kinds of laboratory-controlled experiments. Now, we have to keep in mind, though, their idea of what objective science and controlled experiments is then is very different than what we have now. Science is an evolving method. And so there were a lot of clairvoyants or mediums who seemed to pass scientific rigor. And people go back and look at those cases today and debate them. We have spirit photography and so forth, and people say, oh, that's double exposed, and other people say it's not. Do I know of any one that is really phenomenal? I would say some of the more recent ones are more interesting in that they're closer to the technology of the time and the scientific practices. So there was a former president of the Theosophical Society in America named Dora Coons, and she had was claimed to have clairvoyant abilities to see people's auras, and she helped pioneer therapeutic touch. She would also talk to fairies. She would also look at people's auras and talk about things, problems they had in their previous lives that were showing in their auras, and therapies on how to deal with those. And she would say that people who had, like, Down syndrome or other severe medical problems, those things would also show up in their aura and could be detected by a clairvoyant, irrespective of even talking to them.
Interesting. I was just going to ask how Edgar Cayce fits into this picture in this time frame. Is he also coming out of this movement or purely independent?
No, Edgar Cayce was definitely one of the important kind of early 20th century mediums and mystics and so forth. He was heavily influenced by the Theosophical Society and Theosophy. Other ones are like Alice Bailey, Guy Ballard in the I Am movement. All of these individuals, whether they were members of the Theosophical Society, and in most cases they were, even if it's for a brief time, they were building on theosophical ideas and then carrying them forward. So, for instance, we see with someone like Alice Bailey, Cayce, Ballard, and so forth, a shift from calling the masters masters to calling them ascended masters. Well, this, with the Theosophical Society, they always said that the masters had bodies and they existed in the Himalayan mountains. Whereas these later groups are saying, no, these masters have ascended beyond physical form and exist in spiritual bodies, although they can manifest on Earth. And we see that those kinds of claims and spiritual mediums moving forward to various kind of New Age claims of channeling from the Commander Seven or the Pleiades and Sirius and so forth. These kinds of claims of channeling entities that give information on how society should advance itself. You could definitely follow that kind of continuity back to these early religious movements, including spiritualism and ascended masters and so forth.
Well, that's great. You know, now we've only got about 10 minutes, so we're going to have to advance, fast forward here a little bit. How do we get from there? So there's, there's something that happens, it seems. You've got Yogananda, and you've got Vivekananda, you've got the World Religion Conference in Chicago in the late 1800s, and then you have something happen, it seems, with immigration change, and you have your Shinryu Suzuki, you have Trogom Trungpa, is that Trungpa? And you've got, and then you also have another wave, I think, you've got Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, you've got Muktananda. And so if you can walk us through that up to the Cultural Revolution of the 60s and 70s, and then also then lead in, I guess, to where we are today.
Yeah, sure.
And so, do that in
10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Okay, 10 minutes, century. Let's go. No, we have the situation where all the movements that we've been talking about are definitely laying the groundwork for a kind of spiritual revolution in America. By the time after World War II, we have the baby boomers, and they come back and they have children, and they create a very stable environment for their children. And so in the 40s and 50s, we have all of this kind of groundwork laid for what comes in the late 60s with the hippies and the flower children and all of that, because all of these previous esoteric and New Age and all of these alternative religions were pre-existing. The material was out there, the ideas were out there, and that generation of the 60s just found that material and devoured it. And because they were dissatisfied with the religion of their parents, with the order and structuring of society, they were rebelling against that. And so we see that happening on one side, you know, idealized in the 67 Summer of Love in San Francisco and stuff. But on the other side, we see John F. Kennedy pushing for immigration reform, because up till the 60s, immigration stopped pretty much anyone who wasn't European from coming into the United States. So anyone from Asia and Africa, they were just all banned from coming into the U.S. The quota was either 100 or less a year. And then in the legislation, the immigration change of 1965 after Kennedy's assassination, we see that quota system go away, and there's a huge flood of Asians coming to the United States. And this is really what brings the active participation in these religious traditions. So we get Prabhupada, this Indian, coming over to New York City and going to Central Park and start singing Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. We start getting other spiritual leaders coming to the United States. After the Chinese invade Tibet, we get a number of Tibetans coming to the United States, like Trungpa, like what you were talking about. He goes to school in England and then comes to the United States. So we start seeing changes with immigration really open up opportunity for Asians and Africans to come to the United States and bring their religious traditions with them. And these really start intermixing and creating these new different religious traditions. We should also talk about that Japan has had a long-term influence and bringing Buddhism in. And so we get this kind of mix. Add all that together with the pre-existing alternative religions, and you get New Age in the 80s. And that is kind of carrying forward to today with various UFO or Ascended Master channeling traditions or New Thought traditions. This is another one that came out of the 19th century, but its most current manifestation is The Secret, right? That Rhonda Byrne's best-selling video and book. So all of these kinds of things are very present in the world today, and they all have these historical continuities that go straight back to the 19th century.
And how do you see the internet and the global access to information, real cultural boundaries falling down, not just with immigration laws, but also just the sheer access to information and engagement through social technologies and social networking? How do you see that affecting the evolution of religious practice in America?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, America has what some scholars call a religious marketplace. And what that means is, while in many cultures around the world, the religion of your parents or of your immediate society is your religion, America has the opportunity for people to really choose their own personal religions. And we have so many examples of families of different members of the family being of different religious faiths. So, for instance, like BeliefNet and their religion quiz, right, that will tell you what religious tradition is closest to your values, or the large number of websites that are out there that just have vast amounts of information about different religious traditions that are all accessible and equal across the web. All of them have an address. You can type in them all, and they have just as much ability to present information as all others. Whereas if you look physically, well, certain organizations have more presence, power, money, but on the internet, they're all equal. So this is another way in which this kind of technology opens up opportunities for people who are exploring other religious traditions or trying to craft their own. Because we shouldn't forget that beginning at the end of the 20th century, there's this move away from institutional religion, and people are starting to form their own spiritualities, but rejecting established religion. And they might borrow from a variety of religious traditions to assemble their own spiritual path that gives them meaning and fulfillment. So the internet is just one more part of that, offering access to information and practices. It also offers opportunities for community. So if you are someone who is converted to Buddhism in a very rural town in a part of America, and there's no Buddhists around, you can find community with other Buddhists around the world by going on the internet, by going to chat rooms and so forth. So it really offers an opportunity of connection, community, and information.
So it seems like people are rejecting the institutional, what are considered the sort of standard institutional religions, partly as we see ourselves as more and more as individuals. We can actually look for something that sort of fits our own personal needs. We can, in some ways, craft an individual set of beliefs that work personally for us.
I really think it's part of the overall zeitgeist of the Generation X, Y, the millennials, and so forth. Each generation is less and less interested in identifying itself by connecting itself with a pre-existing institution. Instead, they're interested in defining themselves in more organic ways. And so we see fewer and fewer people joining religious organizations, joining churches, giving their tithes and things like that. And it's not necessarily that they're rejecting Christianity. Some do, but some say, look, I don't need to be in the Presbyterian Church or the Catholic Church or the Episcopal Church to to be a Christian, or I don't need to even go to a non-denominational church. I can be a Christian. I can read my Bible. I can, communicate directly with God. I don't need these organizations. And so we see there's a real emergence of alternative kind of institutions that are more service or needs-based. So a lot of people are starting to see yoga as a component of their spiritual practice. So they'll go to a yoga studio, or they'll go to a metaphysical bookstore or Amazon.com for their metaphysical books. They might go to another store for their incense or candles. And so they'll kind of assemble from these different sources their own religious practices that they might have read in a book or been taught at a yoga studio or heard at a lecture at a particular temple or synagogue or church or something.
I've got a couple quick questions on that. One is, how are the institutional traditions responding to this? And two, can individuals really tap into the deep inner treasures of these faiths through a synthesis like you're describing? What is it generating?
The first one is a long answer, but to give a short version of it, they're struggling. A lot of churches are reorganizing themselves. Some are closing. Some are downsizing. Some are trying to change the services they're offering or market themselves differently. So there's a lot of organizations that are struggling. And this isn't just the Christian organizations. We see this on all religious institutions across the board. People are just not joining in. People are not giving money. The kind of expectations that existed in the past just don't carry forth on the current generation.
John, so, we're in our last 30 seconds here.
Okay. And then the other one, I don't feel qualified to answer. I'm a historian. I'm not a theologist, so I'll use my last 30 seconds today. can't go there.
Okay, great. So we just really want to say thank you very much for joining us on our show. And for those of our listeners who want to learn more, again, please visit John's website. It's www.johnlcrow.com. And there's a lot of information up there, so you can dig deeper into some of the stuff that we just only had time to skim the surface of this evening.
John, just great to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
I appreciate being on. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.